The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. When the government came for disability and unemployment benefits, they were cheered on by high earners sick of an entitlement culture they saw as drip-feeding welfare addicts. But now that middle-class benefits are in the government's crosshairs, and many of those same voices are howling with anguish and frothing like soya milk cappuccinos, it's a brave government indeed that targets the aspirational pockets of Mondeo man and Worcester woman. So how should the government share out the pleasure and pain in the coming budget? Also this week...
We're going to take your vote, a huge vote tonight in Massachusetts, and take that victory all the way to the White House.
In the United States, the Super Tuesday Republican primaries proved less than decisive. What happens next in the topsy-turvy race for the White House? And whatever happened to the party's moderate wing? We'll hear from Jeffrey Cabaservice, an expert on the Republicans, a little later on. But joining me here in the studio, we have The Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland, The Observer's economics editor Heather Stewart, and on the line our columnist Simon Jenkins. A warm welcome to you all. In less than 2 weeks, George Osborne will present his annual budget. Normally, at this time of the cycle, the Chancellor is stuck in what used to be called purdah, with ministers barred from lobbying for any goodies. But coalition, it seems, is different. This week, Vince Cable has let it be known that he wants to have RBS broken up, and he's also been lobbying on wealth taxes. And earlier in the week, Nick Clegg did the rounds on breakfast television amid reports that he's pressing Osborne to tinker further with child benefit cuts.
Clearly, we've said the tax system and the benefit system needs to be fairer. And we have said as a government, we're living in difficult times. So to ask people who earn much more money than others to give up child benefit is a fair thing to do. There is an issue about the kind of, the cliff edge. So you've got one earning family who wouldn't get child benefit under that scenario, but another family with two earners who earn
slightly
a little bit less.
Under.
Yeah, exactly. And so, George Osborne and the Prime Minister have said that's something we will look at.
So, Heather Stewart, echoes of the 10p tax thing here, isn't
very
it?
Much,
something
yeah.
from a previous budget coming back to haunt them, and it's going to probably end up costing both money and making things more complicated.
Absolutely. I mean, it's extraordinary that this row has suddenly broken out when the policy was first talked about by the Chancellor in the autumn of 2010. I think he raised it first in his conference speech. But, and it was obvious at the time that if the way that you take child benefit away is on the basis of how many higher earners, or whether there's a higher earner in the household, whether anyone pays higher rate tax in the household, you inevitably have this anomaly of you can have two people earning just below that and they continue to receive it, and just one earner with perhaps mum or dad at home looking after the children, and they won't receive it. And, that was completely obvious to anyone who looked at the policy immediately it was announced. But it's very much like the 10p debacle, I think, which was, part of Gordon Brown's legacy when he moved to be Chancellor to Prime Minister, was that at the time you get a certain set of headlines, and then it's only when you come close to implementation that people realise the reality of it. And, I'd imagine MPs are starting to get a lot of angry letters from constituents who are realising that as of next year, they're going to lose out quite considerably. The problem for the Treasury, I mean, Whitehall is looking at this. The problem for the Treasury is there's no easy way of solving it, because we have separate taxation, for people within a household, for earners within a household. So unless you were to means test the whole thing, it's difficult to know how you avoid this cliff edge. And in order to means test the whole thing, you need to have information on the kind of collective income of the household. And we only have that for lower income households who claim tax benefits and tax credits. And actually, that approach, the kind of means testing approach and the tax credit system, is something that this coalition government is quite keen to sort of downplay, even dismantle. So it's not an easy problem to get around, it doesn't seem to me.
Sounds a bit like they might have to invent one of those Gordon Brownite tax credits that they spent so long ridiculing.
Well, indeed.
But, Johnny, I mean, the other thing, of course, that's going on here is that whereas the welfare reform bill that has just gone through is mostly about poor people's benefits, this is people who are doing a bit nicer and earning a decent wage, whose benefits are now threatened. And Westminster seems a bit more interested. Funny that.
There's often that syndrome where when it affects them, and that's not just the politicians, but also the people who write about the politicians, there's suddenly more interest. There's also a sense in which the Conservatives can unite very fully behind any policy which is dealing, curbing the deficit, reducing the deficit at the expense of other people out there. But the minute it gets into the Tories' own vote, and I don't mean just them personally, but their own heartland vote, they get antsy. So the argument that which we're going to come on to talk about property is similar to that. Suddenly, when it affects their own constituents and their own core vote, then there's a very, very different reaction. And child benefit for the middle class and you know, two earners in the family, those are Tory voters. And there's a worry that they... and what it reveals, I think, is quite an interesting split there between who the Conservatives think is their voters next time. Is it strivers, in the words of Tim Montgomery from Conservative Home, who thinks the Conservative Party have to put themselves on the side of people who are striving to do well, or are they on the side of those who have already done pretty well and who have traditionally voted Conservative? And that's partly what's at play here and in the argument about property tax.
Simon, do you see those same dilemmas for the Tories?
Yes, I mean, I think the argument is slightly synthetic. I mean, every single tax change has winners and losers. There are always cliff-edge problems. There are always unfairnesses and absurdities. You should just do the thing that's right. And the problem with child benefit was no one could ever quite work out whether it was there to encourage people to have children after the war or whether it was there to help people who are in need because they'd had children. If the former, we have to decide if we want more children or fewer. If the latter, then clearly wealthier people are not in need. The fact that if you have two incomes, you know, you can get away with it. I mean, you know, reduce the threshold. But you cannot, you just cannot make tax reforms on the basis that there should be no losers and no absurdities.
No, I suppose there's something in that when the a time when they're trying to rein in money as well. But with the Liberal Democrats, there's something interesting going on, isn't there, Simon? Because there was a time in the 1940s, a Chancellor had to resign for whispering a few words about what might be in his budget on the day of that budget. And now you've got the minority coalition party going out and making some very overt demands.
I think it's terrific. I love it. I absolutely adore it. I think the fact that everything is now up in the air, everything's been discussed and debated. It's all out in the open. It's not a matter of national security. I don't think the markets are you know, panicking because it's being discussed. I find that the atmosphere of constant debate and argument, and you know, quite vicious at times, is wholly beneficial. I think it's one of the benefits of the coalition is that these arguments are now out in the open.
And one of the arguments this week, finally for you, Simon, has been about whether we should be taxing wealth or income. And you said that it'd be better to go for wealth, I think.
Wealth is difficult. I mean, the idea of people paying a huge percentage chunk of their wealth each year, I think, is ultimately not going to wash. But taxing property, which is in chronically short supply in Britain, is woefully underused or maldistributed. The idea of taxing property, I think, is acceptable and preferable to taxing income. And I think that's actually ingrained now both in the Tory and in the Liberal Democrat ideology of taxation. And the question is, because there are going to be some losers, will they have the guts to do it? I hope they do.
Listening to the discussion, Heather, I mean, you look at the numbers on these things. This was being talked about, Vince Cable's mansion tax, as some sort of trade for getting rid of the 50p rate, where I know we're not quite sure how much money it's bringing in yet, but it's probably bringing in something. Isn't there an argument that you might need both of these things at once?
Yeah, the 50p tax rate the Treasury's estimate at the moment is nearly £3 billion. Mansion tax is really not that big. It's a transaction tax, really. It's not a wealth tax in any kind of familiar sense. I mean, I think Simon's right that we need to look at a more radical reform, and we probably do need to shift, you know, away from earned income towards assets that people are just sitting on, and property being, you know, for many people their main asset. And you do have a sort of structural problem with the economy in these countries that which is we have a housing shortage. We also have a kind of boom bust housing market where you get huge increases, you know, and we have a sort of structural social problem where we have a whole generation of people now who can't afford to buy a home, and yet you have lots of people sitting on, you know, homes that are too big really for them to live in, homes that are empty because they've got more than one. You know, I there are good economic arguments for doing something quite radical. The politics of it, though, are extremely difficult. I mean, when you look at the fact that Labour, you know, repeatedly postponed doing a revaluation of the council tax bans.
It's all based on 1991 valuations.
Based on 1991 valuations, despite the fact that that was in an era when house prices were absolutely rocketing. So an awful lot of people had made enormous tax-free gains on the homes that they bought. It's so politically toxic, the idea of taxing property, that I rather doubt whether there's yet been the political shift that Simon sort of suggested.
Well, we do tax property. It's called council tax.
We do, but it's not nearly as progressive, you know. As Tom says, it's based on valuations of properties in 1991, and there just aren't enough bands to really be progressive enough to reflect the huge divergence of values of properties across the country.
What property brings out as an issue is that, and it goes back in a way to the point I was making before, but where the Conservatives like to train their fire is either those people at the very bottom or the people at the very top, fat cats, the 1%, the bankers.
They're easy targets, aren't they?
Those easy targets. Why property is so difficult is there aren't these obvious fat cats. There are some, but if you're going to make this actually bring in revenue, you have to go for people who suddenly get into that zone which the Tories do regard as their voters, which is people who may be middle class, who aren't on huge incomes, the granny problem, somebody who lives in a very valuable house. And that is where suddenly Tories get very queasy. They're fine about getting
very
to those people
difficult
at the bottom.
I think
fine about hitting people at the top. In fact, they want to, because their own polling says one of Cameron's biggest problems is that they seem like pals of the rich. They like doing things that say, we're going for people at the top. This gets difficult because then you imagine the person who they think actually isn't. They think of them as middle class rather than the well-off.
What, £2 million?
Well, you saw this. There was an interesting discussion on Newsnight this week where, you know, it was all Tories fighting each other. And you had Tim Montgomery again being the sort of spokesman for the strivers who are worried about filling up the petrol tank in the Mondeo. And then you had Kirsty Allsop saying, my parents and my in-laws both have homes worth more than £2 million, but they're not rich,
dears.
She insisted. And, you know, there are plenty of Tories who would feel the way she does, that they could be people, even aspiring people, people who are not that rich, but who got lucky with the housing market, who are sitting on a big asset.
But
so
then
that's
they are
the
rich, because that's an enormous asset that they own. They are rich, you know, by virtue of the fact that they own a £2 million house. But I know that's, for the Tories, that's anathema, that argument. Yeah.
But, I mean, isn't there a danger here? I mean, if you're going to, you know, if you do a tax of 1% of the value of that's above 2 million, you really are talking tiny amounts of money because there's still very few houses in that bracket. If you start looking more like applying it to everyone who's close to or even above a million, and it starts to hit a bit more widely, then you run into those problems that
precisely
on the side of
the
strive.
The thing I was thinking about was what Simon Jenkins wrote about this week. His column was talking about that revaluing, weren't you, about of the top band, and suddenly that will take in a whole lot of people who aren't the millionaires, who aren't the over 2 million, and yet they're the people realistically we need to tax.
Can I say, anyone listening to this in Wales will be falling about laughing. They have an I-band in Wales, or I should say I have an I-band in Wales, and I pay more on a house in Wales than I do on a house in Kensington. There is no big problem with having 2, 3, or 4 extra bands at the top. All you have to do is to revalue the H-band now. It is easy to do, we're right to discuss the politics of it, but it doesn't require any great complexity. It doesn't even require an awful lot of political guts. You're quite right that it does affect the people who frankly, are well off. I mean, they're rich or semi-rich. They're well off. They've got houses worth more than a million. The H-band is now roughly a million. Anyone with a house worth more than a million is, relatively speaking, well off. And all you have to do, you don't have to charge them a percentage of the value, just simply have 2 extra bands on council tax, and you raise quite a bit of money. And at a time when you're saying to everybody right down the income scale, we want to make the benefit system and the tax system a little fairer and a little more economical, you're saying it to people on housing benefit and all these other benefits, there's no reason why you shouldn't say the same to the richer people. And I think they could get away with it.
I suppose one problem that, Simon, I wonder if you think this is the problem, that the trouble with that method is the money, the revenue this raises, then goes to local authorities and local councils, rather than being gathered centrally by the Treasury.
That is a totally separate issue about the allocation of locally and centrally raised revenue. I would leave it local. Sorry, you could leave it local and you could cut the grants from central pari passu. In other words, you could handle it whichever way you liked. The distribution of revenue and grant between central and local government is a totally separate issue from the question of whether you have what was anyway a centrally required banding system, in which the top band is only 3 times the value of the bottom band, although top valued houses are often 100 times more valuable than the bottom. And I repeat, the Welsh have done it. The Welsh had the guts to do it in 2005. I don't see why England can't follow suit.
No, and it was a Labour government that repeatedly decided not to do it, you know, wrongly. I think you're right.
So, Johnny, though, if this does emerge as part of a trade with the 50p income tax issue, which applies to earnings above 150,000, that, I think, is probably harder to present as an issue for the drivers, isn't it? I mean,
it's fascinating the extent to which politics really has moved not only into the battle between Tories and Lib Dems within the coalition, but really within the Conservative tribe, this battle, because there are some who believe that actually they should hold off on reducing the 50p or abolishing the 50p rate, because it does send the wrong signal about the Tories being replacing Tony Blair's New Labour Party as the party of aspiration of Mondeo Man of the Strivers. They wouldn't want to do that. And then there are others, you know, Fraser Nelson, The Spectator, who believe that always cutting taxes is the way to run an economy, for one, if nothing else. And those arguments are very, very strong. And what it just strikes me politically about it that's interesting is Labour is really on the margins of this discussion. This is a battle that's going on within that Conservative family, and that's where all the action is.
I mean, another part of the action this week that we shouldn't skip over is that the Liberal Democrats are assembling for a conference up in the northeast. And in a way, they'd rather talk about tax, because the other thing to talk about at the moment is the health bill that's just gliding towards the statute books. Johnny, do you expect there'll be blood on the carpet this weekend over that?
Well, the Lib Dems at the conference, you mean? I think there will be huge dissenting voices, loud dissenting voices. Evan Harris in our own paper sort of signalling that already, saying drop the bill. And there will be speaker after speaker who wants applause from the party who will be echoing that message. They will think of themselves as very effective in this area. Remember, it was a Lib Dem spring conference that actually got the so-called pause last time round on Lansley's bill, and I think there will be many who think we can do it again and we can kill it off. So there are some very interesting shifts, some movements, some currents there. Just a very, very small one, only for nerds, but James Graham, who's a blogger in the Lib Dems on that sort of Evan Harris social democratic wing, left the Lib Dems this week. It's just a straw in the wind, but he walked away, and he said there will be people who are feeling very, very restive about this bill and will think they have an opportunity to kill it off. Whether so, this will be another test of strength for the leadership. Can they come up with something else, like another pause? I don't think so. Not at this stage. So there will certainly be a lot of anger and a lot of appetite among Lib Dems to try and kill this thing off.
And don't you think that along with the cable letter that was
the lack of vision?
But don't you think there's something also here about the Lib Dems wanting to sort of put down a marker to be able to say, you know, sort of reading that cable letter which was an excellent piece of work. You know, you get this feeling that he wants to be able to say at some point in the future when you know people say to him what did the Lib Dems get out of this government, he wants to be able to have some things to point to. You know, health is one of them, but he also wants to be able to say, look, you know, here I was in a kind of statesmanlike way warning about the shortcomings of our economic policies. You know, he wants to show publicly. It was quite informative, I think, that the letter was leaked to Robert Peston this week, and as we were scurrying around following up the story, we discovered that it had also previously been leaked to George Parker of the FT, and they'd done a story about it a few weeks ago. So you got the impression it had been leaked once, you know, hadn't made quite the splash that whoever leaked it had hoped for, and then it had been leaked again, you know, which someone certainly is keen to get the message out there that you know, the Liberal Democrats have some kind of deep thoughts about economic policy, I think.
I mean, what one thing that's quite interesting here, Simon, isn't it, is that the Liberal Democrats have a rule book. They're a very democratic party, a rule book that not many political journalists have studied until recently, and that could be about to be pitted against parliamentary politics and coalition deals.
Well, I mean, the Labour Party used to have a rule book or a similar sort of democratic structure. I mean, frankly, all these things, when tested in the fire, tend to get burnt. And I think the trouble with Liberal Democrats is, as the Tories see, they just don't know what they want. They want power, and then they get power, and they appear to behave disloyally to power. You can't work out if Cable's a part of the government or he's not a part of the government. It all adds to the gaiety of politics. What it does for David Cameron, I don't know. All I'm absolutely sure is that Cameron is determined not to give way on the health bill, come hell or high water. He's determined not to give way to anyone anymore for at least a period of time. He says he won't give way on the planning bill, where the Liberals have been hopeless. Frankly, I just never know where the Liberal Democrats are coming from. They are a classic centre party without a cause. But they have only one decision to make. That's, do they continue to support, in a confidence vote, the coalition? I think they will.
Well, let's leave that there for this week. You can follow up the build-up to the budget on guardian.co.uk/politics, where you can also leave your suggestions for what the Chancellor should do. But now let's just quickly look across to America, where running for president may be a marathon and not a sprint, but it's rarely quite such a grueling one. As Barack Obama watches on from the White House, perhaps with some glee, his potential potential competitors are still slugging it out in the Republican primaries. This week, we had the usually decisive Super Tuesday polls, which returned a mixed verdict, and the race continues between Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and a cast of other chancers. Joining me on the line from Washington is Jeffrey Cabaservice, who's a historian of the Republican Party. Now, Jeffrey, did this week change anything?
Well, I think the Republican race is not been resolved by Super Tuesday because the votes were spread around for the different candidates who'd represent different parts of the Republican Party and indeed different parts of the country. You did see Mitt Romney being successful in some of the northeastern states. You saw Rick Santorum being successful in the states where there were more evangelical Christians, and you saw Newt Gingrich being successful in the South in Georgia. So what we essentially have is a race that seems likely to continue for quite some time, which is bad news for Mitt Romney, both because this leaves him less time to concentrate his fire on Barack Obama, and also because the longer the race draws on, the further he is forced to tack to the right, and more difficulty he will have in getting back toward the center where most American voters are.
In your book, Rule and Ruin, you talk about Mitt Romney's father, George, I think it was, who you say was very much a moderate Republican. And I mean, just tell some of our younger listeners in particular about moderate Republicanism, because it almost sounds like a contradiction in terms to younger English ears, I think, now.
Yes, it's true. Moderate Republican is an oxymoron nowadays, and liberal or progressive Republican is an even stranger conception. But indeed, there used to be large numbers of moderates in the Republican Party, and during the 1960s, they were arguably in the dominant position within the party. And George Romney, Mitt's father, was governor of Michigan during the 1960s and a candidate in the 1968 presidential race. He was an unsuccessful candidate in that race. And George Romney was someone who really would not fit very well into the model of either party nowadays, because he was fiscally conservative, but he was socially tolerant and in many ways progressive. And someone who was very much interested in the upheavals of the 1960s and did not see them as an incomprehensible challenge to proper authority, but rather thought that protesters, whether they be minority protesters, anti-war protesters, or student protesters, were actually calling for the United States to live up to its own best ideals. Well, I can't peer into Mitt Romney's soul. My judgment is that he is actually considerably more conservative than his father was. I think he has loyalty to his father. He invokes his father's example. But he simply hasn't had the same experiences that his father had. So I don't think that he's somebody who sees himself as a diehard conservative, and that's why the conservative movement is mistrustful of him. I think he sees himself as a pragmatist. But I think he's also more conservative than perhaps moderates give him credit for. I think moderates are hoping that he doesn't really mean a lot of the things that he says, particularly about these whopping tax cuts for the rich. But I suspect he would implement them if he were given the opportunity as president.
If we just peer forward to the general election, and obviously there's an awful long way to go and a lot could happen, but if the result of this protracted Republican battle is a fairly right-wing platform at the election and then a Republican defeat, do you think that could mark a historic turning point where some of the more moderate or progressive currents even that you've talked about in your book could come back and challenge for control of the Republican Party, or do you think it's sort of beyond hope now?
Unfortunately, I don't think that Mitt Romney's defeat, if he is the nominee, would actually clarify matters, because the inevitable response of the conservative movement in the event of a Romney defeat would that the Republican Party lost the presidency simply because, yet again, their nominee was not sufficiently conservative. So in some ways, you could actually argue that we would see a better chance for moderates to make a resurgence within the Republican Party if someone like Rick Santorum were the Republican nominee. Because if Santorum lost on a scale that Barry Goldwater lost on in the 1964 election and dragged down the Republican Party with him across the board from the top to the bottom of the ticket, then you might see the moderates making an argument that the party needed to infuse itself with a broader acceptance of moderation in order to have more of an appeal to the total electorate. This is very similar to the argument, really, that David Cameron made with the Tories. But unfortunately, if Romney is the nominee, I don't think that we will get any kind of clarification of that sort.
And so Tea Party, when we look back in 4 or 5 years' time, obviously it was a bit of a high point in the 2010 elections. Do you think 2012 will be seen as a turning point in its fortunes?
I think the Tea Party is just one in a cycle of resurgences on the right. And they happen in almost predictable 12 to 16-year intervals. So what happened with the Tea Party was very similar in a lot of ways to what happened in 1994 with Newt Gingrich and the Contract for America, and prior to that what happened with the upsurge that led to Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, to the Barry Goldwater nomination in 1964, and even to Joseph McCarthy and his anti-communist movement in the early 1950s. What we have certainly seen is that this kind of upsurge, though sometimes it can go too far and cost the Republicans elections they might have won because a candidate who is too right-wing is put forward. Generally speaking, this kind of political upsurge is good for political parties. They want to mobilize voters and excite them in the way that the Tea Party has mobilized and excited its adherents. But these kinds of movements have most of their effect in off-year elections, such as 2010, where most people simply aren't motivated to take part in the elections. They are low-turnout elections, and therefore motivated, dedicated activists can have a disproportionate effect. The Tea Party is simply not large enough to have that kind of a transformative effect in the 2012 election, or indeed in any presidential year election. So I think what we are going to see is much more of a regression toward the norm, where moderates vote in greater numbers, and moderates will be the ones who determine the outcome of the election.
Jeffrey Cabaservice there. His book, Rule or Ruin, is out now. Now, Heather, he's talking about the Tea Party there. They're all demanding tax cuts. Mitt Romney, the front runner, is giving them what they want, in the sense he's saying everyone's going to have a 20% across-the-board tax cut if he comes to power. But even if the American economy's picking up, they've still got a deficit. Doesn't this, you know, this absolute refusal, not merely to avoid raising any tax, but to cut all taxes all the time, is it making the Republicans unelectable?
There's a bizarre kind of Alice in Wonderland politics in the States, where you simply don't seem to be allowed to talk about how you will raise the money for doing things. You know, so they've got enormous increases coming through in sort of Social Security spending, Medicare, Medicaid, all those things in the future. And everybody keeps warning, including Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, there's a real problem here. There's a real fiscal problem. And you know, they had their debt downgraded by Standard & Poor's last year for this very reason. And yet the politics of it is somehow unreal. You know, it seems to be acceptable to basically promise unfunded tax cuts in a way that it's harder to get away with, it seems to me, over here. But I think that there does seem to be a complete taboo in the States, as far as one can tell, on saying, you know what, maybe some people need to pay a bit more tax. And, you know, as soon as Obama started talking about raising taxes for higher earners, you know, it got written off as a kind of, you know, completely loony left policy. So, I can't help thinking that Romney would have to change his views once he got into power. He might start with a 20% tax cut and hope that it would bring in more revenue, Laffer curve wise, but it didn't work terribly well for Reagan. And, you know, I can't see it's going to work terribly well for him either.
And they're starting with a lot of debt. I mean,
they are, yeah.
It used to be a cliche almost, didn't it, to say that, oh, what's going on in American politics now will be coming to Britain in a year or two down the line. But, I mean, if you look at the coalition that's absolutely obsessed with the deficit and the Republicans that don't seem to give too much of a hoot about it, at least when it comes to the tax side, it seems like there's a world of difference now.
No, absolutely. I've been intrigued with Johnny's view. I mean, Johnny wrote a book, excellent book once called Bring Home the Revolution, in which we ought to, you know, draw lessons from America. I look forward to seeing what ones he thinks we should draw. As Helen says, you have a kind of real democratic crisis at the moment in which, as was said back in the 60s and 70s, you might get a situation in which democracies constantly vote themselves deficits and borrow against them, and whoa-ho, here we found it. That's where we are now. And I think really the language of politics has become so detached from this reality, it's very difficult to see what to happen. But at the same time, and I've always thought the American politics, is sort of looking at it from outside, it has a way of salvaging itself from disaster at the very, very last minute. It may well be that's being tested to destruction now, but I'm assuming at some point or another, the American political community has to say, we've got to reduce these deficits. We can't go on like this. The parallel drawn in that wonderful book, Boomerang, between parts of America and Greece seem to me to be becoming all more vivid.
I mean, Johnny, Simon says you've got a track record of admiration for America's political institutions. Do you think they've gone wrong in the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, I mean,
fundamental way.
I will just slightly defensively say that, of course, that was a paean of praise for the American ideal, the American constitution, rather than the day-to-day reality that you see. But I think there is a dysfunction there, but I don't think it's inherent in the system so much as it's inherent, unfortunately, very partisan point, in one particular party, in what the journey of the Republican Party over the last particularly decade, but it predates that, a flight from responsibility. The fiscal conservative used to be a conservative ideal of the American conservative movement, and somewhere along the way it has been ditched. And so that you have a party that simultaneously talks tough on deficits, but only thinks that the remedy for that is cutting spending, and only one kind of spending, which is just wasteful, liberal, domestic spending. It still wants to be the number one global spender on the military, which drives up the deficit enormously, and wants to cut everyone's taxes, and wants to do all of that simultaneously. The only person, and it shows there is a constituency for it, in this race who is, at least in that narrow way, telling the truth on that point, is Ron Paul, who says if you are a true conservative and want to cut the deficit, you're going to have to shrink the American military and the American empire, as he describes it. But the rest of them, in the spirit of Ronald Reagan, actually, who also wanted to cut taxes and increase spending enormously on the military, that has become a kind of Republican creed, but taken to a huge extreme and you know, intensely irresponsible. And what you have as a result is these ballooning deficits. Very striking. When Bill Clinton handed over the keys to the White House in 2001, the United States was in surplus. It took a Republican president, supposedly a fiscal conservative, to rack up an enormous deficit. And they're at it again now from their perch in Congress, from their majority perches in Congress, in the House, and their sort of blocking minority in the Senate. So the problem, I think, does lie with this one party who've got themselves into this non-governing mode where they are almost insurgents, flamethrowers, wreckers, rather than thinking credibly, responsibly, what do we do to actually, you know, govern the country? And there are some who think the only way this is ever going to be worked is let them have the entire government, the presidency and both houses and Congress, wreck it, and then they'll realise and then they'll learn. But I think that's getting too dangerously close to Simon's thesis about testing it to destruction.
But wild and wacky as they might be, I mean, just narrowly, when it comes to this race, the Republicans now are going to get behind Mitt Romney, aren't they?
Well, I think Mitt Romney's going to win. That's different from saying the Republicans are going to get behind him. I mean, he will be the eventual nominee, but it is a very long and hard road for him. I mean, the upcoming primaries will be ones he may very well lose in the South. He has no record of winning in the South, Florida apart. But he's got Mississippi coming, Alabama coming, and he may well lose there. So it'll be painful. He will, I believe, stagger blooded and beaten across that finishing line and be the nominee. There will be an enthusiasm problem for him, though. I think they will rally behind him to an extent because they really want to beat Obama. But he will excite and enthuse very, very little. I mean, McCain didn't much because they didn't regard him as a real conservative, and they don't regard Romney that way either. And so I think he'll have an enthusiasm problem all the way to November.
So lots for us to keep an eye on there over the coming months, and you can keep an eye on it yourself at guardian.co.uk/US. My thanks to Jonathan Friedland, Simon Jenkins, and to Heather Stewart. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.